Are you a child of the free to be you and me generation? And are you in tune with the world around you? I am a child of the free to be you and me generation. And I am with you in being in tune. We shall bring change to this place. Listen to the whistle of the planet twirling through space. Singing la 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 to the human race. I believe I am the flower of life, the earth, and the ocean. Oh, oh. I believe I feel the power of light vibrate all around me. Oh, oh. I believe you are the children of the one great spirit.
I would like to thank Marcy Playground. That song is called Our Generation. Welcome one, welcome all. This is the Next Step Radio Show on the Antimatter Radio Zone Network. I am your host, Jacob Appleman. Thank you for joining us today on episode number 21. My website has three W's, Infowarts.com. That's infowarts.com. My email address, thenextstepradioshow@charter.net. That is thenextstepradioshow@charter.net. Joining us today, we have a very special guest. Her name is Crystal Clark. She is the author of the book titled, Who Are We Really? 101, Return of the Shaman. Her website is thesoulsociety.com, T-H-E-S-O-L society.com. And without any further ado, let's just get straight into the interview.
If you just want to start with your biography, your personal biography, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, well, it's not really super exciting, but I think a lot of people are going to be going through the same thing pretty soon. And really what happened was, in the year 2000, I was living life like everybody else was. I had a great career. I was making lots of money. And a woman that I worked with at the time invited me to go see a psychic. And I didn't really want to go at the time. But it was a coworker, and we were becoming friends, so I agreed. And she booked our sessions back to back. It was supposed to be 2 half-an-hour sessions. And I went first, and I was in there for 1.5 hours. And I particularly liked the woman. She was very direct. I personally like people that are direct and get to the bottom line kind of fast and don't dance around the bush. So we really hit it off, but the stuff that she was saying to me, I don't think I was really ready for. And one of the things that she said to me was, I wasn't supposed to be doing what I was doing. I was supposed to be a writer and a healer. And she was very nice. I listened to everything she said, and she actually, at the time, had given me my future about 6 years in advance, which, of course, I didn't know until, you know, time passed. So I left the meeting. I thanked her very kindly. I left, and I waited outside for my partner, who was in having her session. And I thought about what this woman said to me for about 15 minutes, and then I was back to the rat race, all the stuff I was going to do when I got home, you know, stuff I had to do for work. And that was really supposed to be that moment. I think that all of us have these moments. We have these encounters, or we have these events in our lives that are supposed to kind of hit the reset button for us, where the light bulb is supposed to go on and we're supposed to really get it. And I didn't get it. And I really didn't want to get it. I really liked my life the way it was. And a lot of other people out there now would say the same thing. You know, don't fix it if it isn't broke. But it was broken, and I didn't see it. And for whatever reason, the universe really wanted me to see it. And a series of events took place where I left the corporate world, and there was just really no way to get back in any meaningful way. And it was to the point that my family, we went bankrupt. It was just a very, very difficult time. And I was struggling against it. And then finally I said, okay, I'll do it. I'll do it. And so I sat down and I started thinking about, you know, what I've been doing all of these other things all of my life. What could I possibly write about, you know, that anybody would want to read? So I started doing research on things that I thought were exciting, that were kind of hobbies on the side. I loved, you know, learning about the pyramids and ancient civilizations and the great mysteries and a little bit of the esoteric. So I started doing a lot of research because I had a lot of time on my hands. And I started to see that all of these things were connected somehow. And I thought, wow, you know, I'll write a book about that. And while I was doing this, I started to realize that I read hundreds and hundreds of books. And I started to realize that back in time, you know, really far back in time, religion and science were not separate teachings. It was a combined teaching. And so I was calling it the sacred science while I was writing about it. And then I started actually meditating and praying and asking for help. You know, it just seemed kind of silly to just write a book just because somebody said you're supposed to write a book, right? You want it to be meaningful in some way. And so I was meditating and I was praying, you know, help me here. What exactly is it that I'm supposed to write about? And I started getting led to really neat sources of information through what most people would call synchronicity, synchronistic events, and then I started getting information in my dreams. It was kind of like just downloading information in my dreams, and that went on for about a year. So in the beginning, while all I had was the book knowledge, I was beginning to see this pattern, but it wasn't until the other information started coming that I realized what this really was. And that's when I understood that I had come across it 100 different times and didn't realize what it was. And it was called the One Law in antiquity. And you can find it in Edgar Cayce's work, Back in the Days of Atlantis. They refer to the One Law there. It's in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Some of the texts that a lot of people aren't aware of, a lot of Christians don't know that most of Jesus' teachings aren't in the Bible. He was raised and taught by a group of people known as the Essenes, and they captured a lot of his teachings, and they're really, really incredible. And I was fortunate enough to get the books from a man, his name was Professor Zeke. And he was allowed into the Vatican's private vaults at one point to translate some of these texts that they had. And these were Essene texts that talked about the One Law. Really, really beautiful stuff. The Essene Book of Creation is a very, very beautiful book. And it talked about Moses knowing the One Law. And that's when I really got it. I thought, oh, wow, this is really something. So that's really kind of how it went. I tried to kind of do it on my own, but it really doesn't work that way. If what we're doing doesn't have kind of a higher purpose, it doesn't really have any meaning. You know what I mean?
Yep.
That's how it started.
So and let's tell everybody the full title of the book.
The full title of the book is Who Are We Really? 101 Return of the Shaman. And it has the 101 in the title because it's actually a study guide. And I did it that way because I realized that the information is not just information. It's very, very powerful, and it creates a personal transformation that can be very difficult because it's so different from everything that we've been taught from the time that we're born. And so I wanted to make sure that I could have people kind of take the journey the way I did it in a way that's a little bit smoother maybe. The transition is a little more subtle. But all of these different sources are in the book so that people know exactly where to go. And any time I could, I contacted the authors of these books and asked them, can I please quote some of your work? So that even if people don't want to go out and get all of these different sources to really, really dig their teeth into the one law, they can still at least have a very, very basic concept of what it's about.
And the return of the shaman part. Shaman has been thrown around a lot lately in different aspects of research. What do you mean by shaman?
Well, you're right about that. I don't think people really know what a shaman is, and I think the only reason we can find ourselves at a place now where we can explain it in any meaningful way is because of the advancement in quantum mechanics. That's really helped. In fact, it's kind of strange if you know the sacred science, but I understand why they do it. But you'll often see a lot of people that know how to work with the field say that they are quantum shamans. And I think that they're doing that just so that people can make the connection to a shaman using quantum technologies, when in fact a shaman by the very nature of the word is an individual who's using those technologies. So you don't really need the two words, but I think people are doing that just to kind of add a little more depth to it. But really, when I discovered the one law and I understood what it was and what it meant, I realized that what we call now the Gnostics were the shamans of their time. And now we have Native American shamans. But they're all using the same technology. It's just a different way of saying it, really. So it's like, the word love, you can say it in 200 different languages, but it's still the same word.
Right. And as far as the return of, where did the shaman go?
Well, that could probably take a while to explain, but if this knowledge is abused, this is the really short version. If the knowledge is abused, it will destroy a civilization. We are on the verge of doing that now. When this happens, if we get to the point where a civilization is definitely going to self-destruct, or if it looks like that's more than likely going to be the outcome, then we could say they're, pre-select initiates or priests, really however you want to look at it, will take the knowledge, they'll hide it away, and they'll wait until everything, all of the dust settles, and then they become the new teachers. That's kind of their job. But it is a spiritual technology, so it's a very personal journey that a person goes through when they learn it. But at the same time, it's also a very real scientific technology. So it's very, very powerful what you can do with it. So if the people that were selected to become the new priests or the keepers of the knowledge, if they decide to use it for themselves, if they become corrupt, then that's where all the shamans go. They go underground, they sell it off to the highest bidder, and then pretty soon we have a world very similar to this one where we have technologies that, you and I are putting gas in our car, but we know that they have free energy technologies. That's a one law technology. They kept it for themselves, and they weaponized a lot of these things, which has a lot to do with the problems that we have now. So that's where the shaman went. He went to the highest bidder, basically, to make a long story short. So it's time for people to have the information, because we can't understand what's happening if we don't know how they did it. In the same way, we can't understand how they're doing it if we don't know the sacred science. So it's kind of this vicious circle. I think it's time. I think it was time a long time ago to give it back. I think that when the atomic bomb was developed, that was the moment. If there were at that time honest, non-corrupt individuals who had it, who were willing to give it out, that was the cue right there. Because that was the first time that we finally had a weapon that we could destroy our planet with. So that was the moment. It came and went. And now we have technologies that, make an atomic bomb look like a piece of wood. This technology can be used to create life, or can be used to destroy it. And what we have now is we have a sick and dying planet. We have sick and dying people. We have sick and dying animals. And we have that because they kept it for themselves. And all of this sickness and all of this death and destruction is a method of control. So the only way out of it is for us to have that same technology and to use it the right way, the way it was intended to be used.
And to take that control back, because a lot of, would you say the powers to be, their control is a lot of our powers we're giving over to them?
That's a big part of it, but we've got to the place that we are now because they have it and we don't. You and I got money instead. They learned about the laws of creation, and we learned about fractional banking.
Right.
So, it's a problem. So, and of course, the money became another tool of control. So, it's not so much that we gave our power away so willingly. It's that we didn't know we had the power to begin with.
Right.
That's kind of where it all started. I mean, how do you give away something you don't know you have?
Good question. And so this is written in a study guide format to not only read the information, but then to make sure, the reader of your book is then an active participant in that journey, because this is a collection of starting points. Is that a good way to describe it? It's a conglomeration of information from a variety of sources written in a study guide format, so the reader then becomes a participant in the learning process, which is a key component to it. Would you say that's correct?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the hope, at least. I mean, I did enough of the groundwork, I think, that it's still very transformational, even if an individual doesn't want to look at any of those sources further. If they don't want to learn the sacred science in more depth, I think it's still very life-changing. But we have a situation now where, because we let people tell us what to think, I don't want to contribute to that. So it's a study guide because I want people to know, where did she get this information? It's not my sacred science. I didn't invent it. I mean, obviously, I did not invent the laws of creation.
Right.
But now that I understand them and I understand what they can do and what they can give back to a person if a person knows, and the reason it's such a personal journey is because once you know how it works, you understand your connection to it and how you are also part of that process. And so that's the really important thing. But the study guide part of it is, even though it's a really long book, there's 22 different sources, and they're all they vary wildly in what their specialties are, but each and every one of them have a very specific part of the sacred science, and once you know what it is, you can really just zoom in on it. And people can get a very basic understanding of it through the study guide, based on the research that I did and the way I'm laying it out for people. But at the same time, I know, and I think you're a lot like me, we don't want to take somebody's word for it because that has a lot to do with how we got where we are,
right?
Don't worry about it. We'll take care of it. Well, they're taking care of it, and they're not doing a very good job. So it's time for us to kind of pony up and pay attention and do our own research. So that's really why I did it that way, is people want to know where I got the information, how far back it goes, and what it means. All of the sources are there. And like I said, I really did try to kind of, drill down a little bit into each source in the book so that they can really get a good feel for it. But I encourage everybody to go out and get those sources so that they can learn it for themselves, because, like I said, it's not my sacred science. I'm just trying to teach people how it works so that they can use it.
And there are 19 chapters plus with like four or five different appendices.
Right.
And due to time constraints, I'd love to pick your brain on each and every one for the audience, but then that's where they just need to go get the book. But a few questions I had that I think could help people initially from the interview to then, spur them into getting the book. And I'd like to go over with you. The first one, in chapter 4, It's called Omission. And I've noticed in my journey through the truth movement, if we can call it that anymore, you have a lot of people and teachers and hosts and broadcasts that focus in on the abundant and apparent in-your-face lie. But there's more to the story than the outward lie that's being told, because there's also that component that they're not telling you. So go over just a thumbnail sketch of the Omission chapter, because a lot of my audience are what people consider members of the truth movement. And I think this is a key component I see a lot of people miss is what's not being said.
Yeah, there's a great deal of truth to that, and what will happen is somebody will kind of get a great lead, and then they'll all jump on that. But that's what's kind of so great about the sacred science, is because you instantly realize how connected everything is. So there's never just one thing. And Omission is a huge, huge part of it, because it a lot of it has to do with redirecting the attention away from that which matters most. Quite often, that's how it works. And so, I would say it's important for people to kind of listen to the whispers of the universe. I know it sounds kind of hokey pokey, but when you hear somebody yelling, generally it's to keep you from hearing the whispers. That's why they yell so loud. There's usually something else going on. And we have that particular chapter. It covers quite a few different things, because people will go to a doctor and they'll get a drug. And we see the commercials. Well, this drug fixes that, this drug fixes this. But they don't tell you that if you didn't have contaminated food and water and all these other things, you wouldn't need the drug. And oh, by the way, the drug is also a contaminant.
Right.
So people leave a lot out. It was done in the Bible. A lot of people don't know that, and I go through all of that in the book, all the sources, so people can go find the sources themselves and research it. But a lot of things get left out, and when you have a story where something is left out, usually what's left out is the most important part. So it's not even the same story anymore, which is really frustrating. So I'm trying to think of a really good example. Well, education is a really good way to look at it. Everybody thought No Child Left Behind was just so great. All of our kids are nobody's going to get left behind. And in fact, that was the chant. That's what everybody was yelling. But if people had listened to the whispers, what they would have heard was, what they're going to do is teach your child the answers to the test. They're not going to teach your child how to deduce those answers.
Right.
So what will happen is, yes, the test scores will go up, but the intelligence of your child is going to go down, and it's not going to be an accurate reflection of what's really going on. So omission is a big problem.
And I think the first example you gave was the one that I generally think of, because when people argue religion or Christianity or texts of the Bible, that's often the component that isn't even argued, is the books that were excluded through the Council of Nicaea and other, political shenanigans, throughout the decades. But I think the other biblical scriptures that were omitted is a huge one that gets talked about. And if people, come from a Christian perspective, understand that, the Bible isn't incorrect, or even the atheist point of view that, hate all religions. I term it, the Bible isn't correct, it's incomplete. And if you study what, the Council of Nicaea excluded, you'll start to see why they excluded it, and then it will make a lot of what they did include make more sense.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And the Book of Enoch is a really great example, because I try to say this as much as I can, because I know that a lot of people have spent a lot of time researching Zechariah Sitchin's interpretations of the Sumerian tablets. But what's really interesting about that is that the Book of Enoch is really kind of the exact opposite story. And what I mean by that is that the Book of Enoch is from the victim perspective. It's from the human perspective. It's not from the so-called God perspective. And it's a very, very different perspective. What is odd about this particular omission is that Enoch was so loved by God that he didn't have to die a mortal death. He was taken to heaven, and then he was shown all of these wonderful mystical things, and then he was brought back to, he wrote 360 books, which is, an awful lot of information.
Right.
And then he was brought back to Earth to deliver those books to his children. Where are they? And why isn't Enoch in the Bible? There's one reference to him that says he was a prophet. Well, that's great. Where are his prophecies? And why weren't they included? And I think that's a very huge omission, because when you start looking at what was left out, you start realizing that things were kind of moved around and cut and pasted. And it's very common to see a pastor or even, followers take a very specific verse and just run with it, because they don't have the rest of the information. And at this point, I really hate to say it, but it's the truth. I think it was purposeful. I think there were a lot of purposeful omissions, and I think there was a reason for it. Probably not a good one. Why would you take that out? If you really wanted people to know the truth, why do you leave pieces out? Right?
Right.
So it's frustrating. I would add that when people get a degree, college is expensive. It's very, very expensive. So if you look at it from this perspective, why would somebody go and get a degree in theology? And when people get these degrees, they are shown a lot of these other texts. They know that these texts are not in the Bible, but they don't share them with their followers. And if you look at it from that context, if you're going to spend all of that time and money getting a degree in theology, why would you turn around and teach it to all of your parishioners for free?
Right.
So you have that side of it, too.
And then comes the control and hoarding that knowledge, and on that horrible cycle goes.
And, this, I just want to throw this in really quick. This goes back to what we were talking about earlier, and this is for me personally, knowing what I know, this is a huge source of frustration for me, because everybody knows that if you tell a child long enough that they're stupid, they will believe it, and it can take a very, very long time to undo that. It's very, very damaging, and that's the position that you and I are in. So first of all, we didn't get the information. And then because we didn't get the information, we basically have people in every aspect of our lives say, "You don't worry about that. You're not intelligent enough to handle that." Government is a good example, right?
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. People who have the right skills, the smart people will take care of it. The Electoral College, right? Why did they create the Electoral College? That's exactly why they did it, because most people aren't educated enough, they say, to elect the right person. So we have somebody else doing it for us. So in politics, we have somebody saying, "You're not intelligent enough, don't worry about it, somebody else will take care of it." In religion, we have the same thing, only instead of intelligence, it's worth. "You're not worthy enough to talk to God, let somebody else do that for you."
We're all the sinners, and then your flock is told, about their sinfulness long enough, and behold, the flock is then, rampant with sin.
Yeah, I mean, and people don't even know what sin means, and that's really frustrating. So, but that's the kind of the point, is if you don't know what it means, and you have somebody telling you, and everybody else on the planet, that you're not intelligent enough or worthy enough to handle these things on your own, and you have to have somebody else do it for you, then suddenly we've been raised, and like we were talking about earlier, in a nanny state, right? Somebody else is doing everything for us. And now we're at a point where you have people saying, "Well, there's too many people on the planet, because they're just destroying everything, because all they do is, is breed and pollute everything." But the fact of the matter is that they can look down on us and act like, you know, we're just a bunch of dummies that don't know any better, when in fact they've worked very, very hard to make sure that we wouldn't know any better. And that is very, very hard to keep seeing around me. People deserve to know the truth. They deserve to know. And it's not just life-changing in that respect because you get your power back, but there was a really, really important breakthrough today. And somebody emailed it to you, and then I sent it to you, so you're already aware of it. But John Hutchison did an experiment with frequency, and the One Law technology is frequency and energy-based. That's what it is. And he found out that he could heal the water in the Gulf of Mexico without anything else but a frequency. Now, this is a man we're talking about. This isn't a god. It's not an alien. You know, it's a man. All he had to do was know how. And that's the kind of power that I'm talking about. So all of this stuff going on, you know, them making us buy oil when we know they have free energy devices, or them contaminating the Gulf when I can assure you they know this technology exists as far as how to heal it the way he did, but they have chosen to weaponize it, and that's where we get HAARP and all of these other things. So it's just frustrating because people have just been led to believe that they can't do it. Jesus has to come and save you. The aliens have to come and save you. The priest has to save you. Your politicians have to save you. It's always somebody else's fault and somebody else's responsibility. But John Hutchison is living proof that we don't need a fleet of aliens to come down here and heal our planet. We don't need Jesus to come and fix it. We can fix it. We just have to know how.
And that's a perfect lead into my next question with Chapter 9, the One Law. Let's talk about that a little bit in relation to Mr. Hutchison and the powers to be, what they have that they don't want us to know about. Let's talk about what the One Law is.
The One Law, it's really beautiful, and I really wish that I hope that Christians will be very open to learning it, because the Bible is really a very, very beautiful book. It's also a very powerful book. And when people see that phrase, then the word becomes law. The sacred science is the laws of creation. It teaches us how to understand how energy flows. But energy is a frequency. And that's what that phrase means. Then the word becomes law. The word is the frequency. It's the energy. It's the movement. So the other thing that the sacred science teaches us to understand is that all of creation is very, very deeply layered, energetically layered. So, and of course, this is where, you know, the quantum physics comes in, and the observer effect and all of these other things, because and superstring theory and superposition especially, because everything is co-creating everything else. So if you change one thing, there's a ripple that happens. And the best way to explain it to people, if it's a very foreign concept, is to look at letters of the alphabet and just pretend that it's like music. Instead of 13 notes, you've got an entire alphabet full. And if you put this thing and this thing, you know, A, D, J, and I, those four notes may create a tree, we could say. You put a different combination together, you get rain. It's energy. It's all energy and frequency. But if you change the frequency of one thing because it's co-creating something else, it changes the other thing. So, for example, every living thing on this planet needs water. Water carries an energy with it. So water is co-creating everything. But we are also co-creating the water, as Masaru Emoto proved, with his water crystals. So It's a constant feedback loop, so we are part of that process, but everything is co-creating everything else. When we don't understand that, in terms of these energetic songs that happen, if we change the water and we give it to something that needs water, but we've done something to it, the thing that depended on the water isn't going to function the same because it's not getting what it needs, right?
Right.
And that seems like a really obvious thing, but it's also fractal. So the microcosm is creating co-creatively the macrocosm. That's the way it works. So in terms of energy, we could say that the alphabet was, these were ingredients. And they're basic ingredients for all life forms, we could say. And this is the really tiny quantum scale, we could say. And all these different combinations happen. So you put four letters together and you get a word. Now you've moved up the scale. If you put four or five words together, you get a paragraph. Now you've moved up the scale again. And if you put these paragraphs together, you get a chapter. And it goes on and on and on to infinity. But if you change one of those letters in the word, it's not the same word anymore. So now it's not the same paragraph. And it's not, you know, there's kind of a ripple effect. And if we were comparing that to music, it's easier to understand because obviously if you change a note in a song, it's not the same song anymore. And all of life is a song. It's a living, breathing, energetic song. And all of these notes are playing on each other. And if you start changing the notes, you start changing the creation. Now, that can be a good thing in terms of what John Hutchison did with this 528 hertz frequency that he used to heal the water. Or it can be a very bad thing in terms of weaponization of it, which is where we get harp. And another example is, for example, the military identified that they know what the frequency of lithium is in your body. Because they know what the frequency is, if they aim that frequency at your body, they can amplify it as though you were given a massive dose. So there are so many different energy songs creating all of the other songs, there are so many different ways to create and destroy with it. And I think that's something people really need to recognize, is that all of these these technologies, all of the different ways that they've weaponized it, they can only do it because they know the sacred science. Once you know how it works, it's kind of like math. It works forwards and backwards, right? So
right.
5 plus 5 is 10, 10 minus 5 is 5. It's that same thing. You can create or you can destroy, and those are the only two things that you can do with it. You can't do anything else with it. That's it. We are part of that process. Probably the most important book that a person could get to really understand this is Masaru Emoto's book called Hidden Messages in Water. And it very clearly shows with images that our thoughts and our words and our intentions program the water in a way that whatever we've done to it, we will take it up again. And so, for instance, if we say a really beautiful word like love or gratitude to the water, it forms a very, very beautiful crystal. If we pollute the water with fluoride or chlorine, or we say things like hate or I will kill you, it won't form a crystal at all, and it becomes very deformed, and we then take it up again. So we are part of that process, and having that knowledge hidden from us has had us largely for a very long time killing our planet for profit, because we thought that we could kill somebody on the other side of the planet,
right,
and it wouldn't affect us. But it does affect us, and another fellow whose research is really great at explaining this is Cleve Baxter. And he did work with plants. He was the world's foremost polygraph technician and authority, and he was teaching government officials how to use it. And he got kind of creative one day, and he decided to hook his plants up to it and see if he could get a response. And he did get a response. And this was a very life-changing moment for this man, because he had a plant hooked up to a polygraph machine, and he wondered what would happen in terms of a reading, what kind of a reading he would get if he burned it with fire. The moment he thought about burning it with fire, the plant went off the chart on the polygraph. And then he did other experiments where he cut a woman's hand. The plant went off the chart when it saw a woman being hurt. He did another experiment where he had fish, it was kind of on a timer so that he wasn't in the room, kind of as a backup to make sure that he wasn't interfering with the experiment with his thoughts. So he left the room, and the shrimp were poured out into boiling water. The plant went off the chart on the polygraph again. Everything is alive, and everything has an energy song interacting with other things. So we can't say, well, who cares if they're killing people in another country? You should care because your planet is feeling it, and the entire planet feels it. It sends out an energy ripple. One of the most important things that Dr. Masaru Emoto discovered, and he didn't know this at the time, but different metals have different frequencies, whether it's mercury or aluminum, things like that. And he was testing the water in Tokyo, and he noticed that all of the frequencies were very, very high. They had spiked for some reason. And he couldn't figure out why, and then he realized that that was the first day of the first Gulf War. So what he discovered is that even though there was a war being fought on the other side of the planet, it was literally affecting the tap water in Tokyo, and it would have made people very, very sick if they had drank it that day, just because a war was being fought somewhere else. So everything is really so connected to everything else. Now, here's something really interesting I would like to add to this, and this is out of his book, actually. I'm going to read right out of his book. And I want you to consider this when you consider what's in chemtrails, okay? So he's talking about negative vibrations that correspond to various elements. And it says, for example, the vibrations created by irritation are equivalent to those of mercury. Anger is equivalent to lead. Sadness and sorrow is equivalent to aluminum. Uncertainty is related to cadmium. Despair is related to steel, and stress is related to zinc. So now, when you know that some of those elements are in chemtrails, is it a surprise to see so many people taking antidepressants?
Right.
Yeah. And the planets also, now this is very interesting, and this is also in his book. He found that planets also resonate with certain metals. So during certain planetary alignments, certain metals can spike. So it's not just our thoughts, it's the planets in our solar system. And of course, this goes back to why astrology is not junk science. Those cosmic rays come down here and they co-create our reality for us. Everything is just so connected. I mean, I could really give thousands of examples, but I don't really know how much time we have left, so no. I want to be careful.
No, yeah, you're doing fantastic, because you always hear that, you know, we're all one, and that sounds pretty, and people hear it and they move on. But this is about the science of how everything is related.
Why we are one.
Right. It's the nuts and bolts of the connectivity between seemingly unconnected things like a pot of shrimp and a plant. So when people say, you know, we're all one, you know, it brings up, you know, hippie feelings and smells like patchouli to some people. But there's actual nuts and bolts, provable realities to the fact that everything is connected. And when you understand that and you can move through your life understanding that your intentions, even bad words, can have an effect on the water, you know, nuclear weapons having, an effect, in the whole space-time continuum. So from the smallest scale to the largest scale, it's all connected on the same scale, just amplified or miniaturized. And so
that's exactly right. If we start doing things on this planet that really start to affect this planet, it's going to affect the other planets in our solar system. If our solar system becomes tweaked, then pretty soon you've got galaxies and universes that are tweaked. And that's the macro scale. But, of course, we have the same thing going on in the body, right? If you have a group of specialized cells working together, that's an organ. If some of those cells malfunction, then the organ stops working properly. And what happens is, because all of the organs work together, that change is communicated to the other organs, and then the other organs try to make up for it to balance it. So really, the human body, nature, all of it is a reflection of these laws, and that they're the same at every scale. That's what people have to understand. If you're seeing it happen in the human body, you're going to see it happen in your solar system. It's the same thing. It's only the scale changes. It's always the same principle.
along the same lines of thinking, when they manipulate the genes of a plant, that, you know, will then have an effect on the human body, that then has an effect on the planet, that then has an effect on the solar system. So our actions are consequential, you know, for a positive and negative, no matter if you think you're just tinkering with an electron or, you know, you're running rocket boosters into the moon. That's going to affect everything around it in like time, you know, just different scale.
That's very true, and I'm glad you brought up the GMO thing, because I think what's so important for people, the reason it's so important for people to try to understand the sacred science is because once you know what it takes to create life, you will instantly know when somebody is in the process of destroying it, regardless of the reason, whether it's profit, whether it's population control. You'll know right away when somebody is interfering with that process, because everything that was originally put on this planet was put here to create, regenerate, uphold, and restore life. That's what it's there for. So our food has the same thing, where the energy songs in food, the food is created to give us what we need to regenerate our bodies. When you start putting in the frequencies of viruses which cause death into the food, now we've ingested frequencies that the body wasn't supposed to ingest, and now we have the body not working properly. When the body doesn't work properly, people don't behave properly. When people don't behave properly, what happens? You know, that you get more crime. You get a guy cutting somebody off, and then, you know, the guy tells him he's number one, and then he goes home to his wife, and he's mad, and he yells at his kids, and that, you know, there's just so many ways that everything affects everything else. I can tell you that I really believe that the church has known this for a very long time, and what really gives it away for me is their portrayal of the devil, because it's a chimera. It's a little of this and a little of that. It's not a pure form anymore.
Right.
We're not supposed to be doing all of these things to our planet. And that's kind of the thing. If you don't know that, then somebody can come to you and say, as somebody I know and love tried to explain to me, that the reason we need GMOs is because it's the only way we can feed all the starving people. Well, if I didn't know the sacred science, because I love this person and it's somebody I respect, I would go, oh, well, then we better go out and hail GMOs, right? That's why it's so empowering. People can't keep lying and changing things, regardless of the excuse. If you know how everything is created, you'll know right away when they're doing something they shouldn't be doing. And you'll also have a pretty good idea what the consequences will be if it continues.
And not only is it easier to tell when people are lying to you, all those little lies we tell ourselves are flashing neon signs at that point.
Yeah, I think so, because truthfully, I'm glad that I stopped working for the corporate world before I took the journey, because I wasn't put in the position that I think a lot of other people are going to find themselves in at some point, where you still have it all, and now you have to try to decide, am I going to try to keep it even though I know what it's doing to me and my family and the planet?
Right.
You know, that's the hard part about it. I mean, it's really, really beautiful, but that's what makes it hard, is because we missed how beautiful it was, and now we're faced with recognizing what it is we've really done by not knowing. But then we have to get to the phase where, okay, we go through that kind of, you know, dark night of the soul, everything we thought we knew was wrong, but then you have to get to the phase where you're working to correct it. You don't have to correct it all at once, and I would imagine that most people would probably go insane if they tried. Baby steps is fine, but at least make the effort, try something, because just the littlest, teeniest, tiniest change ripples out into infinity and can make such a huge difference.
Which leads me right into my next question in Chapter 11, Know Thyself. Find your path, live your purpose. This is where I see most people get stuck. They freak out, or they're easily manipulated. When they don't know thyself, they're really willing to let other people tell them what they're supposed to do or supposed to be.
This is another one of those things that is just, it's so very personal. But the truth of the matter is that every single one of us are the human version of the co-creative process. Every single one of us came down here with a very specific kind of mission, if you will. And us completing that mission would give others what they need to complete their mission. And then it's like dominoes. And the mission was for the improvement and the betterment and the evolution of the human race. What we have now is because people have bought into the money paradigm especially. We have people that they're not living, they're existing. They're existing in a construct that doesn't, it's not real. It's not what we came here to do. It's serving someone else quite well. given the bailout, I would say people are profiting quite well from it. But it's the difference between existing and living. And I really encourage people to try to take that step. There are a lot of different ways to do it. The easiest way is the way that it happened for me, and that's to go to a psychic. And a lot of people really cringe at that because there are so many, 1-800 psychics kind of thing going on out there. The woman who helped me is excellent. She has offered her services to other people. If you don't want to find out that way, numerology is another excellent way to try to get some sense of the gifts you came here for. It may not tell you, or I'm sorry, came here to use. It may not tell you exactly how you're meant to use them, but it will at least tell you what they are. And in my particular case, looking back now, in hindsight, I can see that I was using my gifts in the corporate world, but I was using them in a perverted fashion for the corporate world. I wasn't using them the way I was supposed to be. Now that I'm using them the way I'm supposed to be, I'm hoping that it will be a catalyst for change. I couldn't have done that if I was getting up every day and going to work for the same people doing what I was doing, because what I was doing wasn't helping anybody do anything but make more money.
Right. And do you think quiet meditation is? Do you think that's beneficial for people to strip away a lot of the noise? And sometimes that answer is inside them, or is the third party necessary or easier? Or how would you? Is there other ways besides going to somebody to help you?
There's a lot of other ways. For people who, for the gotta have it now generation, the psychic is really where it's at.
Right.
You want the truth.
No, and I've heard you say try a couple. Don't think you found the one. Hear a couple out, or use that in combination with numerology, and again look for the patterns, because if somebody's trying to lie to you, something will stick out. And when things start to converge, you see patterns, it'll at least lead you in the right direction.
Yeah, if the psychic is a little much for people, and I know it is for a lot of people, they're all really kind of oddball things for the most part, but totem symbology is really great. If there's a particular animal that you just have a real affinity for, or maybe that you see, like let's say a bald eagle. How many people see a lot of those in their life? If there's something that you've seen a lot, go online and look it up. And because there's a reason that you're seeing it. That's another really good way to look at it, I guess, is to understand that the universe doesn't do coincidence. There is no such thing as coincidence. It does not exist. Generally what it is it's the universe trying to get our attention, and we're just not paying attention. We're not seeing it. So it's not so much that the universe just suddenly starts talking to us, it's that we just suddenly start listening. So you can listen to a lot of different things. Meditation is helpful. What people, I think, have to keep in mind is that we create our reality. If people want to work it out through meditation, of course, they can try that. People can try whatever they want. numerology and astrology are also very, very, very good tools. Numerology and astrology are different, though, because these are all different layers that co-create. So letters really do have a frequency. They have their own energy song, which is why Masaru Emoto could put just a word on a water bottle and change the water crystals, because even words have a song. So your name has a song that overlays onto your experience here. The planets themselves have songs. It's often referred to as music of the spheres. So astrology is another layer to your life. So those things, they really help. I mean, there's a lot of information about all of this in the book, how it works, why it works. They're all one law technologies. But I think at the end of the day, people are just going to have to try to find something that they feel comfortable with.
And I think that answered a lot of this, but I had a separate question here about how can this book and this basically incorporating this line of thinking, you know, empower Joe Q. Public to make a difference in his own world, you know, thereby changing, you know, the whole world. And you started it there with, you know, finding your purpose. But is there anything else you could say about how if the average Joe were to read this, what do you think he could take away from it that would first make the difference in his world?
Well, what happened with me, so I'm speaking from experience, although certainly I recognize that everybody is different, and therefore their experiences will be also. But the first thing that the sacred science teaches us is how beautiful this experience was meant to be, and how we've kind of missed the boat because we didn't know. We let somebody else tell us what we're supposed to do with our life, the way we're supposed to do it, and of course, those people are the ones that are profiting from it. So the outer world, this is another really important thing to remember, the outer world is a reflection of our inner selves, and it sounds like a really deep, far-out concept, I know, but if you go back to this very, very simple experiment that Dr. Masaru Emoto did, he literally shows physical proof that this is the case, because if you're feeling angry and you say to the water, I hate you, it becomes so malformed, it's not living anymore. It's literally dead water. If you're behaving that way in front of your wall or your food, that's what you're going to take up. We get back what we send out. It's unavoidable. It happens because it must. That's why it happens. But imagine, if you know that you can do that to the water in a bottle, what about your children?
Who are made of 80% water.
Yeah. What's happening to your children when you yell at your children or your employees? That's the key to the whole thing, is that we understand that we... things aren't just happening to us. We're happening to things.
Right.
So, if we don't know that, we don't really take responsibility for it. And then really, it seems like such a small thing to just change the self. But there's a neat story I use in a book that I tried to teach my son once, and it's called The Marble Story. And he had a really mean teacher when he was in second grade, and she used to really just scream at the kids, not a nice lady. And he came home really upset one day, and I said, I put a marble, and I said, this is your teacher, and I said, okay, this is your teacher's husband. I put another marble down. And then I put a third marble down, and I said, this is teacher's husband's boss. I said, what if her husband's boss was really mean and yelled at him all day, and then he came home and yelled at his wife all day, and then she comes to school the next day and yells at you guys, and then you come home, and then you're mean to all of your parents. So this one person, this guy's boss, has now affected 30 families from just one episode. I mean, that's just one way to look at it. There's so many ways to explain it. It's really hard to choose which one to use. But.
No, and that was a good one, because that's a small example of how our actions affect so many other people. And if we understand that, then when we conduct ourselves or we start to lose our temper, then maybe that thought pops in your head, okay, if I fly off the handle and scream at my employee now, you know, my employee has a family and they're, you know, and we understand that rippling out and the outer world being a reflection of our inner world, you know, we tend to be more cautious. And that was a perfect example because that's an illustration.
You know, here's,
go ahead.
Here's another one. I can't remember if it's in his book or not, but I know that you can find people doing, in this particular book, he's written a couple of different books, Masaru Emoto has, but there's also an experiment with rice. Have you ever seen that experiment, Ben?
With rice?
Yeah. It's a really neat experiment, and I've seen a lot of people on YouTube, just regular people like you and me, who've duplicated it to prove that it does work. And basically what you do is you take a batch of rice, you cook it up, and you put it in three separate jars, glass jars, and you set it somewhere, and every day you give three different kinds of attention to these jars. The first jar, you could say, how much you love the rice, how grateful you are to the rice. The second jar, you would say, I hate you, all of these terrible, mean things. And then the third jar, you ignore completely. Now, this is really kind of a mind-expanding experiment because basically what happens over the course of about a month is that the first jar doesn't rot. The second jar, the one that mean things were said to, rots a little bit. But the third jar that was completely ignored turns black. So people have to understand that the idea that we can just avoid things is often worse than doing the wrong thing.
Right.
You know, don't worry about, you know, what if I, you know, mess it up the first time. It's better to try and fail than to never try at all. And that particular experiment really, really proves it. So, and you can see it in children who have attachments. They have very, very strong attachments to parents who are exceptionally cruel because they would rather have a parent be cruel than ignore them.
Sure.
And I think that all life is that way. And it's kind of that saying that they have, if a tree falls in the woods but there's nobody there to hear it, does it make a sound? Well, of course it makes a sound, but does the sound matter?
Right.
You know, sound, we have a purpose. Everything has a purpose. Recognizing the purpose of things is really, really important. Recognizing the importance of the sun. People don't realize that there's an energetic reaction that happens. The sun, along with all of the other planets in the solar system, are downloading code into your DNA, and that code tells your body, start producing vitamin D. So everything does this. So now we have chemtrails that are blocking out the sun. So now we have interference and an exchange, an energetic exchange of information that we as human beings have to stay healthy. So When you begin to understand all of these connections and how everything is co-creating everything else, you can look around and see that there are things happening that shouldn't be happening, and that if people knew the sacred science, they would know better. And for me, that's the most important thing, because we have a lot of things that are happening right now that shouldn't be happening, and I think that a lot of it, is there an agenda? At this point, I think it would be foolish for anybody to say no.
Right.
But ignorance is what allows it to happen.
We're co-creating, you know, the agenda.
Yeah, we're being our ignorance is being used against us, and I think that was always the point, because you and I can't become the co-creators that we were meant to become if we believe that somebody else has to do it
right
for us. And I think that's, again, that's what's so powerful about what John Hutchison was able to do with this frequency, because he was a man. You know, he wasn't Jesus. He wasn't, and that's another thing. And Christians, I know, really love that story that Jesus turned water into wine. But how did he do it? And there is a scripture that very specifically says that there will come a time when you and I will do things greater than he did.
Sure.
The sacred science is the path. That's the way we get there. When we understand how everything is created, then we're really getting somewhere. And it's funny, because I was trying to explain to someone earlier today how extraordinary and important this development is about what John Hutchison has done. This is the beginning of harnessing our power and taking it back, because if the planet continues to be polluted at the rate that it is by people who are intentionally polluting it and then blaming population control, we're going to have some really big problems. But what was so fantastic about it is I was telling this person what happened, that the oil was gone. And they said to me, a very natural question, and I don't know why more people haven't asked it, they said to me, well, where did it go? And that's a really good question, isn't it? How can you have a vial of water filled full of toxins and oil and then use a frequency to transmute it, and then it's gone? Where does it go? Those are the kind of mysteries that the sacred science teaches people, where it goes.
And where can, if people just get on a search engine and look up John Hutchison with an I, no N, Hutch, I, son, and the Gulf Oil Experiment, and I would encourage people to read about it, because this is one teeny tiny small example of how what you're trying to convey to everybody can be used to better our world. Because we all, you know, talk about HAARP and LRAD and scalar weapons and all this horrible, horrible stuff that's, you know, being unleashed. But that same technology can heal the Gulf, can zap tumors. The possibilities are
disease.
Right.
Yeah. This is my honest belief. It's customary these days. It didn't used to be. It's kind of a new thing, at least as far as I know. Maybe I just only caught it the last couple of years. But to hear people talk about Earth becoming a Type 1 civilization, if we don't know the sacred science, we aren't going to get there. We're like lions in a cage, you could say. We've been trained, and then we go back in the cage. But why would the universe let us out So that we can interact with all of these different parts of it if we can't even understand how our own planet works?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
If we don't deserve that. But at the same time, what's so hard to convey to people is that we deserve it in the sense that we should have been given the information so we could at least choose whether or not we were going to use it right. And that's the thing. Is it possible that if we had been given it when the atomic bomb came out, that we still would have weaponized it and be where we are? Yeah, it's possible. But we didn't get that choice, did we?
No, we didn't have the chance to, you know, heal with it instead of destroy.
Right, and that's really what it comes down to. And I think that people are at a point now where they've seen enough. They've seen enough death. They've seen enough starvation, they've seen enough war, enough suffering, enough disease, enough poisoning of their planet. I think that people have had enough. And these are the tools that will let people fix it. And it sounds so simple, but it really, really does work. You know, in this particular case, I know that people are hoping that the HAARP system will start broadcasting this frequency at the Gulf. Would that work? It absolutely would work. In fact, you could heal an entire population with HAARP, but they're using it as a weapon. That's the difference. Now, people feel like, well, but look at the odds. I'm just one person. What can I do? Well, look what John Hutchison did. If you've got to put it on CDs and have fishermen, you know, blast it in a radio on their boat, so be it. It will work. It will work just the same. But it doesn't behoove us at all whatsoever to say, well, they have all the weapons, so I still can't do anything about it. People have to start taking personal responsibility. And most, whenever I listen to shows with other, you know, interviews and guests, so many people call in and they say, well, what can we do? What I have seen is that the sacred science will show people what to do, but the hard part is having the courage to do it. And that's really true. I wish it wasn't, but it is. And so in the book, when I say that the cure is really, really easy, but it's often us that don't want to employ it, because it will mean giving up an existence that we've become dependent on, even though we know where that path will go. We don't want to let it go.
Right.
So there, it's a very, very personal process of, even though you know, even though you'll know all of these things, and I mean, it sounds really great, and it is. It's very, very beautiful. But there's still that personal reckoning that has to take place, that reconciliation. I hope that people won't be afraid, that they'll find the courage, and they'll go out and they'll start making the right changes. Because it really is simple. We just have to show up.
Exactly, and I can't thank you enough for showing up for the interview. I've been over a ton of this same information. We've had similar journeys in our own research, and you tied it together. If I was to sit down and write a book, it would have been this one, and you beat me to it. So I had to have you on the show to share it with everybody else, because you know, like you said, it's a big book. It's transformative, but it's also pretty simple and, you know, a must have. So let's tell people how they can get the book, your website, and things like that.
Sure. And first of all, thank you for the compliment. That was very sweet. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
You can get the book at my website, which is www.thesoulsociety.com. So it's www.thesoulsociety.com. And SOUL stands for Students of the Law, in case people are wondering. And, you know, there are great people that are on there that are offering some of their services for free. I think that a really big thing that we have to start considering is getting away from money and going back to the barter system. There are people that are offering their services there to help, and if anybody else wants to, you're more than welcome to join. It's just about people that get it trying to come together and find a way to use it, you know, in a constructive way that's you know, where you don't feel like you're having to give up so much. You know, people can, you'll have somebody to kind of lean on for support who can say, like you, for example, what you've been through with your radical unschooling, right?
Right.
Now that they know somebody who's done it, well, it's not so scary, and they have somebody they can go to for advice. And it's so truly that kind of thing. That's what it's about.
I purposely left the Soul Society to the very end, because that will be a request for interview number two in the future. But first, I wanted to get the audience directed towards this book, you know, have them understand, you know, how these things tie together, how the one law works. And then, you know, your next venture and your website are a logical next step in your path. And with your gracious, if you would graciously accept, you know, I'm extending a second interview in the near future, but not too distant. So, and I'd really like to go over that concept also, once people understand this, how we can work together and network and barter and exchange without fiat currency and all the other forms of manipulation that get in the way of real progress and real solutions. So, again, I thank you for that, and I don't want to cut that topic short, but that'll be interview number two for everybody listening. But, again, we'll have all of your website, everything linked, you know, when I post the interview, and we'll definitely get that information sent to you as well, so you can link it at your website and, you know, move forward with this newfound information, or I should say refound information, and, you know, one step at a time, turn this thing around.
Hey, you know, that's all it takes. It, you know, people, I know it sounds too good to be true, but it's really a matter of just one person at a time. It really does work. And thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And yeah, anytime you want me back, I'm there. Just let me know. And thank you so much, Jacob.
All right. Thanks a bunch for your time.
Okay. Have a good night.
You too. Bye.
Child of the free to be you and me generation. And are you confused with the world around you? I am a child of the free to be you and me generation. And I am with you.
la 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 la. There's nothing to it. I believe I am the flower of life, the air, and the sunshine. Oh, oh. I believe in the power of light, the motive for the universe. Oh, oh. I believe you are the children of the one Mother Earth.